Case number 20-1973, Philip Gibbs versus Erica Huss. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Martin, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Benton Martin on behalf of Mr. Gibbs. I'm reserving 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
A habeas petitioner should not be barred from raising a constitutional violation for failing to contemporaneously object to that violation if the state court knew about it and the defendant did not. The district court here wrote a very narrow decision and thoughtful decision, applying a procedural default rule, and solely a procedural default rule, to deny the habeas petition, though it called that application of the procedural default grossly unfair, but it believed itself bound by this court's decision in Bickham versus Wynn. Our position is that Bickham should be distinguished for three reasons. The first of those reasons is the first two are factual, and the first one is that in Bickham, it was the unique situation where the defendant's counsel had notice that the courtroom was being cleared of spectators during jury voir dire. The attorney had even objected at that point, and afterwards tried to object again, but did not contemporaneously. And the court...
What do you mean contemporaneously there in the sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, I thought that either he didn't know or didn't raise that his family or his defendant's family wanted to come in at that point. That is, I thought that he saw the courtroom cleared, including those people, but then did he know or not know that they wanted to come back in?
The sense in Bickham was that he did want them to come back in, though he didn't express to the court after the courtroom was cleared that they wanted to come back in. Why that's different from this case is that there's no evidence that this attorney knew at all that people were being barred from coming into voir dire.
But did he know that the defendant's family was coming? You would sort of think that normally you would if you say, you're going to be on trial and family's going to come to support me.
There's no record evidence of that he knew they would be coming. And in particular, there's...
Apparently they did not come at the beginning of the voir dire, right?
That does appear to be the case.
The judge flatly said, jury's going to come up, people can come in, and they didn't at least. I don't know whether anybody came in. Do we know that?
We do not.
Because there was some seating available, as I understood it.
The trial court did say that there was some seating available.
Okay.
The district court made the point to say that it's unclear whether there was anyone who remained in the courtroom. And the district court also emphasized in saying how troubled he was by the procedural default rule here is that the trial court did not announce, although he said that spectators would be welcome, did not say that the courtroom would be closed during the voir dire itself and didn't make that announcement on the record, which is, I think, a difference between this case and Bickham. Because in Bickham, when there's a sense that, okay, people are leaving, but we want them to come back in, I do think there's a factual distinction to be made there in saying that attorney should have noticed, okay, these people aren't back.
You're saying that attorney was more delinquent than this attorney. Is that basically the distinction?
Well, I think yes, and that there's more of a reason to hold that attorney responsible. And not this attorney who really had no idea. And that put this case squarely on all four corners, in my view, with the Gupta case that we cited, where there was no knowledge until after the trial was done that family members had been excluded from a voir dire. And the court there in the Second Circuit decided that they weren't going to put an obligation on counsel to raise an objection that they didn't know about, that counsel didn't know about. The district court also very carefully explained why, in its view, Michigan courts don't apply, or at least don't regularly follow, the procedural bar in circumstances like this, where there really is no knowledge on the part of counsel of a constitutional violation happening. I also think it's relevant, and the second factor I think distinguishes this, is that we know in this case that the trial judge did know that the courtroom was being closed during voir dire. In the Bickham case, the judge made comments to the effect after counsel objected after voir dire that, well, if you'd only let me know, I could have let specific people in. In this case, what happened was in the direct appeal, they were allowed a remand, and the Michigan Court of Appeals said, we want you to hold an evidentiary hearing. It said, shall hold an evidentiary hearing on this question of the courtroom closure. Instead of doing that, the trial court said, well, I don't need an evidentiary hearing. I know what happened. This is my practice. I closed the courtroom during voir dire. Really, it appears there was no corrective action here that the district court was going to take, or the trial court, excuse me, was going to take.
You say he closed it during voir dire. That is, he closed it to any new entrants during voir dire.
Correct. And I think that looking at the purposes of why Michigan courts apply a contemporaneous objection rule is so that there can be corrective measures made at the time that a decision is made. And this really dovetails also with the merits of his claim, in the sense that Waller and Presley in the cases about courtroom closure put the burden on trial judges to make findings and factual findings about why they're closing a courtroom before. The language of Presley is...
We do require some sort of an objection, right? I mean, then if not, I suppose then you get into plain error, but generally we require an objection. I mean, I dissented in Bickham, but, you know, it wasn't enough just that it was closed.
I think that the distinction here is that there is an argument to be made that it is not defaulted when the counsel has no knowledge. I think the difference here is the absolutely no knowledge that
Okay, so you're saying that because the circumstances are different, the trial court should have held a hearing. You're not saying you automatically get relief on the merits. You're saying the trial court should hold a hearing and make a determination of whether the lawyer knew this was the court's practice or had any knowledge that there were family members, just everything, right? Everything relevant to this?
I do think that there could be further factual findings on those issues. For the purposes of this appeal, we're only asking this court to reverse the application of the procedural default rule that was applied. And allow
the application of that default rule, at least based on some of the issues Judge White raised, itself might be a factual matter. Because, for example, the things when you say, you know, with some, I'm not faulting you for saying it, but the defense counsel had no knowledge, you know, we don't really know that. We don't know what the circumstances would have been. Might be right, but... you know, if you put the defendant on, I guess you could, would you expect this to be done in the federal court or in some way remanded to state court to make that hearing that you want?
If there were going to be factual findings, I think we could supplement the record in the federal district court. I don't think there's a dispute here amongst the parties that there really is no evidence that the lawyer knew about this standard practice. There's certainly no evidence that this was an announced practice. And I think that that's
practice, but I'm talking about, you know, who wanted to come in. For example, I didn't see anything where the defendant says, I had no idea my mom was coming. Although I take it the mother probably wouldn't have been admitted anyway because she was a potential witness, right?
Right. The evidence we do have about the courtroom closure comes from the family members and their affidavits when they say that they tried to enter and were turned away at the door. And that's the evidence that
we have. That's what I thought, that we don't have the...
And then we also have... the trial court saying, well, of course they were turned away because that's what I do, essentially, is right. I close it during voir dire.
But the question of knowledge seems to be somewhat relevant in the sense that you probably wouldn't be here if somebody hadn't tried to come in, it would still be, from your argument, a violation, right? Even if, you know, this wasn't an interesting trial and nobody happened to want to see it.
Right.
Which raises the question then of, you know, at what stage do we look at factors like prejudice or like, you know, calling the courts into disrepute, because all of the evidence seems to be that the voir dire was conducted fully and fairly and contentiously. And so the absence of the family members, there's no specification of any problem because of that, is there?
No, we haven't raised an argument of that. The only thing I believe...
Assuming we undid the procedural default, would that be part of the action on remand?
Correct. Is the discussion of prejudice. And the district court explicitly reserved ruling on that. And really, prejudice comes into play in two ways. When one is the third point of why I think Bickham's distinguishable, and I'd like to hit that before my time runs out, which is that...
But before you go into that, are you saying that your position is that the right to open public trial is only enforceable in the absence of prejudice, that the requirement is not a requirement unless the defendant is prejudiced by the absence of a public trial? Because that sounds like what you're drifting into based on the comment you just made.
No, I don't believe that we need to show prejudice. And the position in our briefs is that this is an instant where prejudice can be presumed because of the importance of the trial, of the public trial right.
So is prejudice always to be presumed, or is it based on the factual circumstances of the individual case? And do you have any cases that would pertain to this question?
It is dependent on multiple things. It's dependent on the type of claim being raised. I also think it's dependent on the factual circumstances. And I'd point the court to Weaver. Weaver actually itself deals with the public trial right. So it's significantly on point. It does not presume prejudice in that case because it was raised in the context of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim rather than a standalone prejudice inquiry, rather than a standalone, excuse me, public trial right claim. And so the court in Weaver really addressed, do you still have to show that second prong of Strickland when you're raising a public trial right, which is a structural error? And there's a number of reasons laid out in our briefs. I won't go through all of them right now, why I believe that Weaver actually supports our position that prejudice should be presumed here, though the district court didn't go into any of those, and I think it's a complex inquiry. So I would ask that if the court not rule on prejudice, but if it agrees with us on distinguishing Bickham, allow the district...
Well, what's your position as to why prejudice should be presumed here?
For the reasons laid out in Weaver, I think there's three. That, number one, Gibbs raised this in a direct appeal, which I think is different than raising it just in collateral proceedings. He raised the violation of his public trial right. Number two, I think the reasons for the courtroom closure are important. Weaver makes that clear. And this case, there was a routine unconstitutional practice by the trial judge, is our position. And the third, is that in Weaver, the closure was a decision apparently made by court officers. And here, it was the court itself. So I think that those facts put this, if you read Weaver, in the type of claim that should, where prejudice should be presumed.
Yeah. Could I ask one more? You had started out by saying you had three reasons. Can you just state the third reason, not argue it, but just state it?
Yes, and this prejudice is part of that. And because the last reason is that Bickham at the very end says there's no evidence of cause and prejudice to excuse the default.
Okay.
And I think we do have cause here in that it was conduct attributable to the state that would have caused any default if there is a default. So I do think that that's the third reason. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
May it please the court, Eric Restuccia from the Attorney General's Office, appearing on behalf of the state. This is really not a courtroom closure case. It really is a court management case. And I say that because no one was asked to leave the courtroom, but rather the state trial judge prevented people from leaving and entering during the voir dire. There's three bases.
Well, that's not an established fact, is it? I mean, it's sort of murky as to what actually occurred in factually.
Well, I don't think there's any dispute. Maybe there's one underlying fact which is unknown, but at the beginning of trial, the court said, we're going to get the jury to come upstairs now. If any spectators would like to come in, they're welcome, but they do have to sit over here by the law clerk. Those are kind of the first words out of the judge's mouth at trial.
And subsequently, it was determined that there was only one or two seats over there. Is that right?
The question of how many seats were still open seemed like there were still some seats open. That was on the record. And then the family members were not allowed in because the voir dire had started. In my view, this is like the small vein of cases of courtroom management. Like
where do you get the information that the reason they were not let in was because the voir dire had started? Where is that established?
Well, at the motion hearing, the court said, this is her practice, that the way she conducts voir dire is that once it starts, people are not allowed in or out. And that's exactly the analysis of the Michigan Court of Appeals.
He didn't make a finding as to what occurred in that specific instance the defendant is complaining about, did he?
Well, the Michigan Court of Appeals made this statement, which I think is entitled to deference unless there's clear and convincing evidence to the contrary, which is...
Well, if there's some factual statement, basis for the statement, certainly it's entitled to deference. If there's no factual basis, that's a different...
Well, I think that the trial court had said that it's her practice to allow people to come in before voir dire begins, but it's too confusing once it begins. And then the Michigan Court...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
She said that at the second go-round. She did not say that
that's right.
In the courtroom
that's
or
right. So there was nothing
by
there.
Any general order.
Yes, that's exactly right. Right. So this was at the remand where the trial court was asked about the practice, and she
So let's play that out. I was a trial judge for a long time, and I know that some judges have the practice of, in closing arguments, you close the door. Okay. I don't know why it's confusing to have people coming in and out during voir dire. It just, you know, that doesn't ring true to me. So let's say the court announces it and says, this is my practice, and somebody says, the defense lawyer says, well, you know, we would object to that. We think it should be public, and there doesn't seem to be any basis for it. And then you would have a dialogue, and it would be up to the court to show that there really was a need to close it. And I think it would be very hard to show that. So I don't think it's enough just to say, okay, this is housekeeping. This is... management, court management, as opposed to excluding everybody when you really are excluding people and the need for the management isn't apparent. So what do you say about that?
If this were a direct review case, I think those...
I'm sorry, what?
If this were a direct review case, I think those would be legitimate considerations. But this court, the Michigan Court of Appeals, found there to be no error. Its factual predicate for that finding was that the court had appeared to allow the spectators who were still in to remain, but it took the posture that no one was going to be leaving or entering during voir dire, and it found there to be no error. This court, on direct review in Dugalek, had a circumstance in which the courtroom locked the doors during closing argument. And the analysis of this court was there was no Sixth Amendment violation. There's a small vein of these cases, which are ones in which there is the control of management. It's Bell in the Fourth Circuit, Lampley in the Tenth, Herring in the Second, in which the analysis of the courts, and one of those is a direct review case, was that there's no Sixth Amendment violation. Now, is it best practice? I don't think it's best practice, but it's certainly not clearly established Supreme Court precedent that says that's foreclosed, because the only two cases are Presley and Waller. And in Presley and Waller, people were asked to leave the courtroom. Spectators were expelled, and there was an objection. Neither of those things is present here. This case is, frankly, much more like Dugalek, in which the courtroom said, I'm closing the doors. Now, that was said on the record, I understand. So there could have been an objection in a different way, of a different character than is present here. But nonetheless, this court said, on direct review, that there was no Sixth Amendment violation for closing the doors during closing argument. Now, I think by analogy, if we look at this in habeas, which then has to be clearly established Supreme Court precedent, and of course, if you look at the universe of cases, it's narrow, right? It has to be...
Supreme Court precedent say that there's a procedure that you're supposed to employ?
If there is a Sixth Amendment violation, and that's a threshold question, and it's not clearly established. In fact, if you look at the Bickham case, the underlying district court decision there was that there was no clearly established Supreme Court precedent that would show a partial closing. And that's where people were asked to leave and they couldn't get back in. Here, the record as presented to this court is that the way the Michigan Court of Appeals evaluated it is that it appeared that people could not leave nor enter. And that's what the court said that its practice had been. And in that posture, there is no clearly established Supreme Court precedent, which shows that to be an unreasonable application of the law, because we don't know what the United States Supreme Court would say in the absence of an objection in which no one was asked to leave the courtroom. And I think that's, I mean, the court was asking questions about a possible remand to evaluate the procedure default under cause, whether Bickham is distinguishable, and a further prejudice analysis, which I think is clear that he has an obligation to show actual prejudice, but...
Shouldn't the district court decide in the first instance, number one, what happened, and number two, if there's a procedural default, and number three, if there isn't, whether there's been a violation based on the facts as the court finds them?
It seems to me that the what I would recommend to this court is that follow a Gateway versus United States. It's a decision from 2020, in which this court evaluated an alternative argument from the government in which all of the pleadings were sufficient for the court to rule. I had it right here with me, I'm sorry. But it's 979 F3rd 391. And the analysis from the court was, where all of the briefing has been sufficient on the issue, and it is apparent from the record that the court is able to rule on the question, that this court has the authority to rule. And that's what I would recommend it does in this case, because the issue has been fully briefed both below and in this court on the issue about whether there was an objective misapplication of established Supreme Court precedent.
So that would pretermit the procedural default issue. In effect, you're saying, you know, assuming that there was no default, we can jump to the merits, and on the merits say there's no clearly established precedent.
That's right. I think that's the easiest course, because the idea of this going back to the district court and for it to weave into whether, you know, what happened 10 years ago. I mean, part of the Weaver analysis from the United States Supreme Court, looking at prejudice and what happens when you have structural errors that are defaulted or where there's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, it's a difficult kind of analysis. There's no reason to get into any of this analysis on the threshold issue, which is straightforward, which had been briefed below and is briefed here.
What you call the straightforward analysis would be that there's no clearly established Supreme Court precedent that, what would you say, this type of courtroom management is unconstitutional?
That's right. So when Judge White, when you were asking,
we would presumably have to say, take the best view for the defendant of what kind of management it was, wouldn't we?
Well, I think you would take what the Court of Appeals said was its factual understanding of what happened. It says, we find no error given the trial court's statement. It appears that the courtroom was open to the public initially, but then closed once jury selection began. Seems to me that this court is bound by that factual predicate, and unless it can be established by under 2254E2 that's clear and convincingly wrong.
Well, the best position then would have to be that the family did want to come in, they were there, and they were not allowed to come in for only the generic reason. That is, there's no statement that even if there were only two seats that they were occupied, right?
Right, that there could have been room in the courtroom, but the practice would have been imposed on them since they
and
couldn't enter because voir dire had begun.
The question Judge White raised is, you know, what's the reason? Is it really that noisy? Does it intimidate the jurors, blah, blah, blah.
And I think that same issue was present in Dugalek on direct review, which is I'm not going to allow people in and out during closing argument. And this court said that there is no Sixth Amendment violation where you close, you know, close a courtroom. You're just not allowing ingress and egress because that's not a closed courtroom. And in fact, that's part of the analysis in these other cases, Bell and Lampley and others. They find there to be no Sixth Amendment violation. So I think this court can avoid going into Bickham, whether it's distinguishable, even the prejudice analysis, and go right to the threshold question of whether the Michigan Court of Appeals was objectively unreasonable in concluding that there was no error, where the Presley and Waller cases frame it. And in both those cases, there was an expulsion of spectators. People were forced to leave, where on this record, there is no claim that people were forced to leave. But rather, the suggestion is they were unable to enter because the courtroom had started. I think that was, in fact, one of the affidavits that said the voir dire has begun and you cannot enter. So really the factual predicate is one of courtroom management. And the issue is whether the United States Supreme Court in that circumstance, where there is no objection, would find there to be a basis for relief. And the answer is no, it's an open question. And if it is an open question, the state courts can't be found to be objectively unreasonable denying relief where the United States Supreme Court precedent is limited to its holdings under Woodall, and it has to be the specific question addressed by the United States Supreme Court in Woods versus Donald. So the range of analysis for this court is limited because of the posture of the case.
Counsel, what is your position regarding when a trial judge can close off the trial proceedings from the public without committing a constitutional violation? What sorts of factual circumstances can that happen, in which that can happen? Or is it your view that there's never a constitutional violation when the public is denied access?
I don't think the United States, what do I think the right legal answer is on how that should be treated by an appellate court?
I want the legal position of I want the legal position of your client in these proceedings in this case. That's what I'm asking
about.
And
I think the answer is that the United States Supreme Court has not resolved that question. And because it has not resolved that question, the Michigan Court of Appeals analysis cannot be objectively unreasonable. This court is constrained. You're asking me to answer what should be the right answer on direct review. And I say
if you're saying the Supreme Court has not resolved the issue, what you're saying then is that the Supreme Court has not enunciated a public right, has not enunciated a constitutional right to public proceedings. That's the implication of what you're saying, and I'm not so certain that's correct.
Let me respectfully disagree. That my position is much like what the Fourth Circuit said in Bell. It said the trial judge neither ordered anyone to leave the courtroom nor closed any portion of the trial from public altogether. Bell's right to an open public trial was not violated.
I was asking you whether and under what circumstances can a judge preclude the public nature of the proceedings without committing a constitutional violation, and you really haven't answered the question.
My answer is that this court, when it's stated, I'm a trial judge, I'm going to have closing arguments. I'm not going to allow people in or out during closing argument. This court said doing that was not a Sixth Amendment violation. You're asking me, should that be a violation? But this court has said no. Now, that was a circumstance which I told.
I wasn't asking not just that. I'm asking you for some rules of the road as to when, if ever, a judge can choke off the public nature of the proceedings without committing a constitutional violation, and respectfully, you still haven't answered the question.
My answer is that there is no constitutional, clear violation of constitutional rights under Supreme Court precedent when I engage in courtroom management, which doesn't expel any spectators, and there is no objection.
Well, wouldn't it be fair to say that your position is that what happened here and in similar cases is not preventing public observation of the trial.
Just exactly
that,
right.
Just that they didn't follow certain pathways. Now, that may or may not be right, but you're certainly saying that you can't just say nobody can be here, period, ever.
The record here was that the court said, spectators stay. When we start voir dire, then, she didn't tell everyone this.
Were you embracing Judge Box's statement just then or not?
Yes, well, I agree.
I understand you to be saying that if the court doesn't affirmatively exclude people, kick people out, and doesn't say nobody can come in and observe this trial, then everything else is sort of courtroom management.
If my position is if there's a short duration in which the court does not allow ingress or egress, the precedent from this court, unpublished, and from other circuits says it's not a Sixth Amendment violation. I acknowledge that those were circumstances in which the court told the gallery and others what it was doing. That didn't happen here. I understand that. But my point is there's nothing from the United States Supreme Court which says that that action of saying everyone, all spectators have to be here at 8:30, that's a constitutional violation. It doesn't tell us that. It's an open question. And because it's an open question, it can't be that the Michigan Court of Appeals made an extreme malfunction under Waller and Presley when those cases, there was an objection and there were people asked to leave the courtroom, which did not happen here. Those distinguishing factors are critical because the specific question that this case poses has not been answered by the United States Supreme Court. And consequently, this court is without the authority to overturn the state court determination.
Counsel, I believe you're out of time.
Yes, I am. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
We'll have rebuttal.
I went a bit over, but if I could just have a minute of thank you. Respondents moved on to the merits, and I would respectfully remind this court, this is a court of review, not first review, and our opinion is that this should go back to the district court for determination on the merits, and this court should resolve the issue of procedural default, which was the narrow issue that the district court ruled on. As to the merits, though, I disagree that the Supreme Court has not spoken on what happened here, because in Presley versus Georgia, which is the most, I think, salient case, it says that Waller, the earlier case, provided standards for courts to apply before excluding the public from any stage of a criminal trial. And then it goes through that the party seeking to close the hearing must advance an overriding interest, the closure must be no broader than necessary, a court must consider reasonable alternatives, and it must make findings adequate to support the closure.
But the court didn't close the voir dire proceedings. The court didn't let people in while it was ongoing.
And I think it's fair to read Presley. I agree. I think it's fair to read Presley that saying if a court is going to exclude the public, which I do think it's fair to say the public was excluded from this. People wanted to come watch it, and they were excluded from coming. And I think that before that happens, Presley makes clear those findings, whether there's reasonable alternatives, findings about why that closure is necessary have to be made on the record beforehand. And I'd point the court again to Gupta, that Second Circuit case, which is very similar on this point as well. And it emphasizes that word before in Presley and says, this is what the Supreme Court requires. It requires that these findings, whether you're going, and the district court said this too, whether it's, even if it's a partial closure,
I'm sorry, when you said the Supreme Court said even a partial closure, or are you saying that's
I said the district court.
District court said.
Yeah, it made brief comments on the merits and said, and it said even if this, basically saying
I
would
like. Agree the Supreme Court hasn't said anything about partial closures, by partial meaning either by time or by number. I mean, obviously we know that number has to apply because even in this courtroom we filled up sometimes, but what you've really got here is a timing. Either you've got to show up at a certain time or you've got to stay.
Well, Presley was just limited to voir dire. So in terms of temporary,
I
think
that, but even within the voir dire time, they didn't say nobody can attend voir dire. They took action which had the effect of excluding some people from voir dire for timing issues. Would that be a fair way to put it?
In this case, yes. I think it's clear that Presley covers that. And I think that the cases that have been cited by respondent all had that announcement, those findings on the record. And so they're all distinguishable on that basis. And with that, I thank this court for its time.
Thank you very much. The case shall be submitted. And when the table is clear, the clerk may call the next case.